privilege to not only be the session host, but also to be a contributor, and I'm very glad to share this information. A little bit of background for me, I have a day job. I have a master's in electrical engineering and been in industry for quite some time. And about 5 years ago, I just got the bug to get back into education. And my wife works at Biola, so it was an easy decision to go ahead and take classes. So I got a master's in science religion, and I liked it so much. I just said, well, there's a sister program. Why don't you do the one in Christian apologetics? I love that, and I finished that, and now I'm finished with that, and I still love it. So actually, I just got involved in a PhD program to continue these things. And so this intersection of faith and science, I think, is really very interesting. And I appreciate the talks that we've had. What I'd like to talk about is what I'm calling the nature of information. And I wanted to look at three different perspectives and see if there's a way that we can kind of glean a better understanding of what actually is the essence of what we find in the genome. And I have a one chart called a briefing roadmap. What I want to do is tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then tell you what I just told you, and then have 3 points, so I guess that makes it a good sermon or a good talk or something like that. So basically, I'm a real optimist that, you know, I think I really think that there's a divine intersection that's going on. I think with the commonality of what we have at ASA, that that God is involved in somewhat what we would see in DNA. And so what do we find there? Is it actually divine code? Is it divinely inspired? What would you like to think about it? What can we do in a sense like a data exploitation? I have an engineering background, or from a forensic sense. Can I get an understanding of, well, if God is a programmer, what kind of stuff would I find? Would I find evidence of design patterns? What type of things are that we can pull out of this? And a little bit of the conversation started to come with some thoughts that maybe would be thinking along that line. So genomic research is producing tons of data about what we find in terms of the genome. What I wanted to do was go to the source. If you wanted to think in from a sense of, like, if you wanted to learn about the New Testament, you want to go to the Greek. Well, if you want to learn about the genome, you want to go to actually the nucleotide sequences and see what you can start to figure out. A couple years ago, I had no idea even what a nucleotide was, but it's really been an interesting exploration to start to see a little bit more. And with my background in engineering, maybe see if I could see what the actual data states. And so I try to be as impartial as I can. I do have my own view, and as we all do, but I was trying to do in a structured process where how can I present some of this data forms and let the data speak for itself. And I did something that what I do at work is something called an analysis of alternatives and sort of went through that process. So let me just explain what I'm going to do, and then it'll make it a little bit easier to go through the material. So from a scientific point of view, I found three things that were in the literature that were some interesting things that I think are fairly challenging to come up with a good understanding of what's the explanatory scope for various worldviews and how would they approach this. So the first thing was incredibly interesting was that this idea of overlapping proteins, that you have a protein that be coded in one direction, and you have another protein coding in the opposite direction. That happens in multiple times, and I'll talk about a specific example. There's multiple codes, that the way that those nucleotides are used, there's multiple ways that those same bits of information are used. And then what I would call, the way I would phrase it, is it seems like there's optimization in the standard codon table. And I'll use some engineering perspectives of things that I'm familiar in my day job of why I think that there's evidence that would show that. When I talked to somebody that was into bioinformatics, and I was talking about these three areas, he said it's very easy to kind of tie theology and philosophy together. But to tie science and theology together in a very practical way such that information would be useful from a scientific point of view, that's very difficult. And so I kind of struggled. I said, wow, what could you do that maybe could give some perspective of the divine essence and apply it in a way that might have some relevance to science. So I'm interested in collaborating. If you have some thoughts, both at now or later, my contact information is here. I'd like to dialogue a little bit more about that. But the idea of infinity and timelessness were some characteristics of God that I found that might be interesting. And so I'll have a little bit of thoughts about that. And maybe that might be an example if we could allow for things that we can't imagine. You know, we have a finite amount of energy. We don't have infinite resources. And we don't have infinite time. How does that kind of change the perspective? And finally, from an ontology, how do I look and analyze what is fair game for me to establish a worldview or a way that I'm going to go about doing what I do? And then I did some analysis of alternative of putting those perspectives together. And because of time, I probably won't get into that. There are some backup charts, and if you guys would like me to come and either over the phone or if there was a venue you think that would be useful to talk about this further, of course, I'd be glad to do that. So first of all, from the scientific point of view, a fact that I found was interesting, about 99% of the human genome was the same for everybody. So the individuality within 3 billion base pairs of information, that the uniqueness that we have is a very small percentage. And then a question that I kept coming back to is, what is the explanatory power for some of these kind of challenging areas? And try to look at all these various points of view, these worldviews, and consider that. So kind of going into a little bit more detail, and then I'll go further when I get into some more charts for each of these three things, is overlapping protein sequences that it still blows my mind. You know, I've done a little bit of programming. I love programming. I'm not great at it, but I still love doing it. My brother is probably 10 times better than I am. But the idea of having like a compiled bit of programming that you could be actually doing a counter and go in one direction, and it means a certain thing, a certain function, a certain data set, and then you go in you increment in the opposite direction, it means completely different, has a completely different function. It just blows my mind. So maybe that's not very scientific, but from a personal sense, and maybe that's what I experience, is that sensus divinitatis, you know, that there seems to be a divine encounter with, just like seeing a beautiful, I'm from the West Coast, and seeing the ocean. It to me, starts to ring about something that just goes beyond, and it requires a deeper explanation. And I don't have all the answers, but it makes me start to think about that. And then I'll give some more specifics about multifunctionality in the DNA. And then there was some interesting ways of looking at the standard codon table that I'll talk about, and the color coding even that I use on that chart. Well, I'll come back to that, and it has some relevance. So first, overlapping proteins. An analogy that I thought that was illustrated for me, to if I always have to explain this to a layperson, it's almost like if you had a music CD and you played it in one direction, it would play Beethoven, and I played it in the opposite direction, and it would play the Beatles. The data set doesn't quite show that to that degree, but as an analogy, it's pretty profound that there's stuff that this I don't even know how to begin to program like that. There's like a design pattern that's just beyond me. And I don't even to have a compiler that would have enough capability to actually consider that. I think it goes beyond, you know, what I could imagine. It would probably take, you know, supercomputers to figure out all the various permutations that would be necessary to make that possible. So, like I said, I wanted to go back to the source. So, if you will, the Greek for cells, to actually go to nucleotides. And there's an interesting program. That actually, it's called Skittle, DNA Skittle. And so it gives you a visualization for each of the four nucleotides. It has a different color. So you can actually look at the raw data. And so even just looking at the raw data, you can see that if you were to look not very detailed, it says, well, is that random? We know it's not. But you could, if you actually start to look at it in a larger aggregate, you can start to see some interesting patterns. There's something called tandem repeats, and I'm not going to get into that. but there's some interesting parts of the genome that just by doing this in itself, that you're actually getting another sense of data exploitation, a sense of what is actually going on in the code. These two areas are examples that have this overlapping genes. And so the one on the bottom, I'm actually going to go into more details, and all the references for the information and the where I have for these data sets are here if you wanted to look them up. So if I was to go to NIH's website, they have this neat visualization to show in this one complex region called NF1 that it gives all of these examples of these various genes that exist. And what I wanted to do, just because to make it simple for me, was to pick a short one. So I chose this one gene that's, I'm just going to call it OMG, so that it actually is overlapping within this NF1 region, and start to look at that in a little bit more detail. So that's number one. I'm going to come back to this a little bit as I start to get into the next two areas. But I once again, I just think that this is just by itself, it's profound. That almost like a music CD, you play it one direction, it's one song, and a different direction, it plays something else. Some other talks have mentioned this, but then there's these multiple codes that exist. So you can have something that there's nucleotides, there's amino acids, and there's all these other types of codes that exist that help in the utilization of that information. And I'm going to focus on this something that's called a transcription signal, which is the first one on this list. I'm going to see if I can get someone else to help me that, so I don't have to time myself, and you guys know I'm being fair. So you can help me if I start to go over. Okay, Walter. Once again, looking at the literature, this was one of the ways that you could start to look at the basic text, if you will, of this OMG gene. And what I started to do was underline the various places where there was a stop code on. And then I started to annotate some other information of where there's a transcription signal. And so you have this multiple layers of information. There's nucleotides, there's amino acids, and I start, this is from this reference, but it specifically lists the kind of amino acids, if you were to go three by three, what is here. Using this DNA Skittle tool, So in yellow, I'm showing that here, although it's really hard to figure that out, but this OMG gene is contained within those bits, if you will, those nucleotides. And there's another way that you can start to annotate, well, where do these transcription signals actually start to show up? So within this gene, in this specific example, is four times where this transcription signal shows up. And there's also, in the midst of this gene, there's all these stop codons, where, you know, I'm not a bioinformatics expert. I'm maybe a little bit better than I was 2 years ago, but it seems a little bit odd that there would be all of these stop codons. It's supposed to mean that this is where you're supposed to stop. So it's somehow supposed to know that, well, I really didn't mean that. You're supposed to continue. And one of the things that there's actually what's called a reading frame. There's actually six different reading frames based on where you were to start. And so what I, using the standard codon table, I mapped what were the actual amino acids that would be there in this specific sequence. So looking at the OMG gene, where there's a transcription signal, and I listed these six different ways that you could interpret that information, plus having this transcription signal. So it's just a little bit, giving you a little bit more insight into that specific area, there's a number of different ways that this information could be used. So the third area was the standard codon table, and there's an interesting way of kind of looking at this based on the color scheme is related to, is it, you know, acidic or base, is it attract water, repel water? I'm not really going to go into that into this talk, but the same color scheme here is used in this what I use in the next following chart for my color scheme for the standard codon table. And there's so much more I could talk about this, but I won't, partially because I'm not an expert in it. But this next chart is What I'm using it for, it saved me a lot of time rather than actually physically count how often in a human genome exemplar do each one of these nucleotides occur, do each one of these amino acids occur, and I started to do a little bit of statistical analysis based on that. So that's the point that I'm bringing in this chart. And then I started to just kind of do accounting and comparison and just wanted to see where the data led me. So this is kind of a forensic, you know, data exploitation exercise that I started to think through. And so there, if you look at the how often each one of these occur, that's what I show in the top graph. And if I was to do it in a rank order, that it's listed here. You can see that some are definitely more favored than others. I have more questions than answers in this brief. So first of all, I don't know why that occurs. I would love to be funded to continue to work on this. So if you guys are interested in this, I'd love to come talk to you about it. But and then, so I looked at the nucleotide and looked at the various amino acids. And then I started to look at, well, using the standard codon table, how does that kind of relate for just looking at that same data, but just aggregating to the next level up? And I then started to do the same thing, not only for a whole genome, but looking at a gene. So looking at the specific OMG gene that I talked about, and then I looked at two different data sets to see how they compare with one another. So this is kind of a chart that I wanted to show, and if I'm going kind of fast, I apologize, but I don't have much information. I'm probably going to get a warning fairly soon. Was the standard codon table favors certain ones of these elements more than others? So why is that? You know, I don't have an answer, but I started to look at, well, how often are they seen within the whole genome and in a specific gene? And there seemed to be some kind of a correlation that the ones that have like six different cases that code into that one thing, that seems to correlate well to what's seen in a specific gene and a specific instantiation of a human genome. To me, I think that's profound. It at least indicates that an interesting correlation. I'm trying to just be honest and see what the data leads me, and I think as a minimum I can say in an unbiased way that's an interesting fact. Okay, one of the things that I started to see when I saw this this table, the standard codon table, was something that I'm familiar in communication theory with stuff that I've done in my day job. There's something called 64 QAM, quadrature amplitude modulation. It's a way of coding a lot of information electronically. And there's 64 cases that come out. And if you want to hear more about that, just email me and I can send you a reference. And so I started to play this through. How might this be seen from a standard codon point of view? So I use that same coloring scheme. And you see that there's a lot of different times where there's multiple space where this is like error correcting margin. So when in a situation like there's six that code into one, that would indicate to me that is a perhaps more important, or there's a reason why that's a critical element within the standard codon table. And so that was just an interesting thing that I started to see as an interesting artifact of what I was seeing in the data. Finally, in terms of information theory, there's been a lot published over the years. Unfortunately, I'd love to would have been like one of the first people looking at this, but you know, I have the reference below. But to think in terms of like Shannon's way of making an information channel and looking how DNA and cellular processes what goes about doing that, it reads the information from DNA. It then has to take those various information. It's not like a contiguous sets of information. It's various elements, pieces it together, forms it into that messenger DNA. There's various kind of error sources, noise, genetic noise that have to be considered. And then that's when you then do the transcription and formulation and assembly of proteins. So with that, that's my first of my three. So I apologize. That's probably the most detailed one, but to me also very interesting, and also starts to create a fabric where then how can I start to tie in a theological and ontological point of view. So the omnipotence of God and timelessness of God were things that I started to think about, that how could I start to apply this towards genome analysis or other things. And so perhaps that this chart might be a way of graphically giving you a perspective. Is there's a verse, Deuteronomy 29, the secret things belong to the Lord, but the things revealed belong to us and our sons forever, that we may observe them. It's an okay hermeneutic to be using this. I'm kind of using it out of context, but I think there may be a sense where this is applied to just sort of frame. There's things that we can understand that are easily understood, but there's things that aren't, that there's maybe a degree that with a little bit of a scientific analysis, we can analyze that physical evidence and make those inferences. And then there's a whole nother area that goes beyond our capabilities for a number of different reasons. And perhaps what I'm trying to address here might be a way that we can maybe get a 10% more of understanding that goes into that area that's very difficult, if not impossible, for us to understand, and maybe bound that. So from my engineering perspective, a way that I might think about that is like band-limited signals, that even how we see, we see in a certain limited spectral range. We don't see the whole picture. We have, in every possible way, we have a limitation. And in this chart that I've tried to use a Fourier example, and it may be profound. I had one person say this is really profound or really dumb. So I'm hoping that's really profound, but it could be really dumb. But there's kind of a relationship between the, you know, God being eternal, that he's not bound by time, and God being omnipotent. If you've ever heard of something called the Dirac delta function, in the time domain, it means it has infinite power and zero duration. And that equates, in the Fourier transform sense, it means going from minus to plus infinity, all time at once. So I find that is incredibly interesting, and a way that might be a way that we can begin to have a glimmer of an understanding of what it means that God could live outside of time and yet have relevance to understand a single period of time. Even you and I, with our sensory abilities, we cannot distinguish a moment of time. We have to time average over a certain period of time because of the way that we were made, and there needs to be a detection time to process that information. So with this chart, if that didn't make sense, maybe this might provide a little bit of perspective. And what I was trying to do with this idea of our limitations and resolution. In every possible sense, like with this picture that I have in the background, if I was to assume that this antenna array, that's the real source, in a sense it's almost like we see this blurred image. And when I showed my wife this for the first time, she was thinking, was that golf balls kind of lined up together? Without knowing this real source, you may, if this is fuzzy enough, you might not be able to get a clear perspective. This number two, it's one of our cats. We love our cat. But if you have this distorted picture, you're going to be able to understand that it's a cat, but you're probably not going to recognize that our cat Tigger has freckles on his nose. And so that's an example of some of the information that's lost, that's not detectable in a direct sense. And so this third analogy that I show here was like this Skittle DNA, that's what we can observe. But if there's something at a higher level that perhaps we don't have a way to observe, detect, to model, and so maybe we can begin to get some perspective by considering these limiting conditions. And finally, the third area is an ontological perspective. Is what is in our toolbox that we use to create our worldview, our way that we do our science, and how do we validate that we're on track? So I'm not a philosopher. I tell you, so this is a little bit difficult, but there's some basic things that I can figure out. And so some of the graphics here, I think, will make my point. And I'll, just due to time, I probably won't spend too much discussion on a few of these things. My thesis advisor, Scott Smith, kind of helped me through some of this. And a basic way that he simplified it, or put it in a direct way, to experience an object, one has to form a justified true belief. And how do we actually know reality? On this chart, I tried to simplify it, and he had a long narrative, and me tried to make it into a quick summary. I tried to group that into some three thematic areas that we need to assess: external input, we need to have an awareness of self and knowledge of reality, and third, be able to evaluate and grow. So there's some basic things that how we need from a philosophical sense and to know what is reality. This is probably the main chart in this area for this section that I want to point out is a differentiation between two ontologies, a physicalist or a dualist. And I tend to be a dualist, and one of the reasons why is it's like the analogy, you can't see the forest for the trees. If you only have a physical realm to understand what is in the physical world, you don't have an alternative, a second dimension to be able to be an external to observer to quantify, is that on track or not? If I have a spiritual sense, I can have a thing that's out of my frame of reference to offer some corrective information on whether I'm missing the boat or not. And so on this chart, I tried to pictorially show this, and I could have used just about anything in my example. But if we use like the straight line is that, you know, over time, various types of influences have come in, and that's kept us in a sense as on reality. But what if there's something it made a lot of sense, but it then started to take us off into a tangential direction that was self-consistent, but it didn't correlate with reality. And I could have put methodological naturalism, I could have put physical naturalism, I could have put intelligent design, I could put anything there, if you will, if that's an issue for some. And so I'm not going to get into my analysis of alternatives in details, but how do I add these various elements? And how do I create my own worldview? And what are the various possibilities? And I think that if we consider all three things of these elements, I think we're going to get to a lot better position than if we were to just leave it to just science. I love science. It has its shortcomings in the sense that there's some things that we just can't figure out. But if we were to leverage some of these other things, say from a theological or an ontological point of view, does that help to give us a starting point to help save us to some time to get a more meaningful explanation? My argument is perhaps that actually does help us out and should be considered. So I just finished up with this chart. Genomes are a rich data set. It's one of the areas that I think there's so much concentrated information from so many different points of view, from so many disciplines, that I think you could actually get some interesting results and more insight from it. And that's I think it's just amazing. I think that integrating scientific, theological, and ontological perspectives helps us to stay aligned with reality and kind of gives us a check, a sanity check, to see if this holds together. And if there's a time where people want to hear more about it, in my backup charts, I walked out in the formal sense of walking out some metrics and the analysis of alternatives for various ways of how these things couple for a number of different worldview options. So with that, I'll turn it over to questions.
Yeah, you got time for one or two. Yeah, the black.
Are you familiar with Jean-Claude Press?
I think so. I think that was one of the references that I found. I have a lot more stuff in my thesis than I have here. So there was this.
Because the first time I saw that chart with the sitting codon frequencies,
yeah,
was in his work, and that's all related to golden ratio.
Yeah, that is actually my reference. Yeah, so thank you for reminding me. It's actually here. That is from Jean-Claude. So thank you.
And I like your Fourier.
Well, good. So one vote for brilliance and
drag delta function.
Yeah. If I can get
one more question. Okay.
So your antisense or your reverse order or sorry reverse direction genes on the MHC markers.
Yeah.
Were those in introns or in exons?
How about if I first of all, once again, I have to admit, I'd love to be, but I'm not, you know, informatics expert, a bioinformatics expert, so I don't want to answer that incorrectly, so I'll have to give you an answer offline. Or we could just collectively go into that website that I have a reference and we'll find out.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.